I hit him 2 more times before grabbing a can of ant spray I had brought out earlier and using it to spray him in the eyes. Ben hadn't read the write-up he'd done 12 years ago because he'd wanted to hear it all straight from Gina.
Did he get away?
She nodded. Unfortunately, yes. He stumbled to the door. By the time he got the chain unfastened, I was on the phone in the kitchen dialing 911. It was too late. The police arrived 10 minutes later, and he was long gone. The silence settled around them before Ben asked,
"So how are you doing now, Gina, 12 years later?"
"I don't sleep well, and I suffer from panic attacks. I've been to the doctor many times. It doesn't take much to set me off. Constant worry, shortness of breath. Sometimes my reactions are unprovoked." She shook her head. He killed Harry. Why in the name of God would he kill a poor, defenseless animal? Gina seemed so frail and agitated by the remembrance that he didn't have the heart to ask her about the death of her son. Instead, he sat with her for a while longer and talked to her about happier times. When he left Gina Eberling, she was giving her caretaker flack about what she was cooking for her next meal. As Ben drove back to the office, though, Gina's question about how anyone could kill her poor cat, Harry, wouldn't leave him. And he knew why. 6 months ago, Ben had begun to see visions of bloodshed and carnage. Unsure as to whether the images had anything to do with his life prior to his accident, he'd decided to look into his past, which included a visit with his sister, Nancy. That visit occurred 10 weeks ago, and yet his conversation with his sister had stayed with him, haunting his dreams. Nancy had always made it clear she wanted nothing to do with him, but Ben needed answers, and he couldn't see the harm in asking her to help him fill in the gaping black hole that was his childhood. But forcing Nancy to see him had been a mistake. Her fear of him had been downright palpable. Her trembling lips and the way her gaze kept darting around the room made him feel as if she might flee at any moment. But she remained seated, and when she finally mustered the courage to look him in the eye, she'd told him he used to collect dead animals and bones. She said he was a frightening person to be around. The only reason his sister had agreed to talk to him was because he'd promised never to return to Florida to see her. For months, he'd been looking for answers to his past but had only ended up with more questions. Would his memories never return? And if they did, what then? "Be careful what you wish for," was a phrase that often crept through his mind. Had he ever been, or could he still be, some sort of monster? Ben held tightly to the wheel as he released a heavy sigh. Perhaps it would be best if he simply listened to his wife, who repeatedly reminded him that the past no longer mattered. He was no longer plagued by grisly images of death. His sister was out of his life forever, and his father was dead. Let it go.
7. Lacey had no idea how much time had passed. Hours? Days? There was no way to tell. No tiny crevices of light. It was the sort of darkness found under a bed in the middle of the night. If she allowed herself to think about it for too long, her imagination got the best of her, and she would become numb with fear, waiting for a sharp clawed hand to cover her mouth and nose and smother her. Her head throbbed. She felt weak as she reached up and slid her fingers against the particle board. The dent was much larger, deeper. They were getting close, but it would take a while. She tried to remember how long someone could survive without water. 3 days? 4? She'd read stories of people lasting more than 8. They had been indoors, no sun or heat. Her left leg was cramping. She needed to stretch, move, and bend. Holding on to the pipe, she stretched her arm as far as it would go to the right. The tip of her finger brushed against Jason's hand.
She scooted that way and slipped her hand into his. She remembered the first time they'd held hands. He'd brought her to one of his construction sites, a large office building in Folsom. After placing a hard hat on top of her head, he took hold of her hand and gave her a tour. The place was busy. Knowing Jason was in charge of something so grand made her feel proud. His employees showed him the utmost respect as they walked by. Jason had started his construction business from nothing. He was a hard worker, determined to be successful. He believed quality was king. He refused to cut corners to reduce costs. He often said that his company's reputation was only as good as his last project. Over the years, she'd learned that some of his workers considered Jason to be a hardhead, a stickler for perfection. He hired only the best people, and he expected a lot from them. It wasn't long before he began to act the same way at home, refusing to accept anything less than perfection. She didn't mind. She liked working hard and being the best she could be. But now, lying here in the dark, her eyes were being pried open, and she was beginning to see Jason in a whole new light. Her thoughts shifted to the day of their abduction. She'd spent hours getting ready for their anniversary dinner at the firehouse. It had been so long since they had spent quality time together. Her pulse had raced every time she'd thought about telling him the big news. Swallowing the knot lodged in her throat, she decided to make the announcement. He was her husband. For better or for worse, he needed to know the truth. "I'm pregnant," she said. He let go of her hand, his movement jerky.
"I need water. I don't have any saliva."
Stunned by his self-centeredness, she went back to her pipe and took in some air. Did he not hear what she just said? Did he think he was the only one who was thirsty and afraid? Was his fear causing him to shut down to all else? Too confused and angry to speak, she used her feet to push herself the other way. As she did so, she reached out her left arm, surprised when her hand brushed against something crinkly. She inched her body that way until she could feel something that seemed like a paper bag in her grasp. She then scooted back for air, bringing the bag along with her.
"What are you doing?" Jason asked. "Have you been hiding something from me?"
She cringed. How could he think so little of her? Being angry or annoyed with him wouldn't accomplish anything, so she ignored him instead. The bag was the size of a standard grocery bag. It had been folded closed. Keeping the pipe in her mouth to breathe, she held the bag on her stomach and used both hands to open it and reach inside. There were two items, an apple and a water bottle. Her heart soared. Her mouth watered. She was so hungry and thirsty.
"What is it?"
Jason asked, his voice panicked.
"What are you doing over there?"
"I think it's a water bottle and an apple," she said. "Reach to your right and see if there is another bag over there on your side."
"I can't do it. The pipe will fall, and more dirt will come in. I need water. Please give me some water, Lacey. Don't be selfish."
Stiffening, she did what she always did when it came to Jason. She did what he asked. Reaching out, she placed the plastic bottle into his outstretched hand that she couldn't see but knew would be there. While he drank up, she pulled the apple from the bag and brought it to her nose, inhaling its sweet scent before taking a bite. Juice trickled down her throat. It was the most delicious piece of fruit she'd ever tasted. Her stomach gurgled and grumbled as she chewed.
"Don't eat all the apple,"
he told her. She took another bite.
"Here's the water," he said. "Let's trade."
She handed him the apple. For a fleeting second, she thought he might not give her the water bottle. She was wrong, but it wasn't until she unscrewed the lid and drank that she realized he'd only left her a few sips. Nothing productive would come from getting angry, so she bit her tongue. "Stay calm. You can do this," she repeated over and over in her mind as she picked up the shoe by her side. After taking a series of deep breaths from the pipe, She lodged the shoe between the wood floor and the pipe to hold the pipe up, and then inched her way to the upper left corner of the box, making her way slowly around what little room there was, her fingers brushing over every bit of space, hoping to find more food.
"What are you doing?"
"Trying to see if there is another bag." She was near his feet. She began to feel hot and clammy. Her chest tightened, her throat burned. She wriggled her way back to her original spot. Panicked, she used her feet to give herself a push. Her shoulder hit the shoe. The end of the pipe clunked against the wood and dirt leaked in.
"What's going on?" Jason asked. "What's happening? I don't like you being so secretive over there."
Her heart rate spiked. She needed air. She felt around until she found the pipe and tried to shove it back through the hole. Dirt blocked its path. Panic set in as she sucked in dry, hot air. It wasn't enough. Her lungs burned. She jiggled the pipe around, pushing harder, desperate to get it back into place. Relieved when the dirt finally gave way and the pipe was back in its original place. Dizzy, she was afraid she might pass out. After the dirt stopped falling through the pipe, she brushed the mound of dirt to the side and put her mouth at the end of the cylinder so she could breathe again. As the air filled her lungs, relief settled over her and she was able to think again. Since the pipe hadn't come all the way through, she couldn't be sure how deep they were buried.
"Lacey?"
She closed her eyes, took slow, deep breaths. It was a while before she said, "I'm okay. It's not getting enough oxygen that we need to worry about. If we don't get out of here, there's a chance we could be poisoned by carbon dioxide."
"How do you know that?"
"I saw a show on how to get out of sticky situations, like being trapped in a small space or if you find yourself in a car that's sinking into a lake or..."
"What about the other bag?"
he asked, cutting her off. He wasn't listening to her. He didn't seem to care that she'd just risked her life to find water and food for both of them. The thought that kept running through her mind was, "This is not my husband."
"What about food and water?"
he asked again. Reining in her frustration, she said, "If you're still hungry and thirsty after drinking the entire water bottle and eating 3/4 of an apple that was meant for both of us, maybe you should take a look around, Jason."
"I can't do that."
She'd never been confrontational. In fact, she went out of her way to avoid conflict. But at the moment, all she wanted to do was scream at the top of her lungs. "Jason," she said in a stern voice, "are you kidding me?"
"What?"
"This isn't just about you. I'm freaking out over here because I'm trying to do whatever I can to survive. Moments ago, I told you I was pregnant. You've made it perfectly clear that you don't care one way or another." Venting felt good, so she kept it up. "Even before we got shoved in a fucking box, you were quiet and distant. I need you to grow a pair and help us out of this situation." Once again, he remained quiet. It was dark and cold. She'd never felt so alone. Shivers snaked up her legs and arms. As she rested a hand on her stomach, praying the baby would be all right, she thought about the apple and the water she'd found. Was their captor testing them? Why would he leave food and water if he wanted them to die? Nothing made any sense. But for some reason, it gave her hope. Reaching around in the dark, she found her shoe. With it firmly in her grasp, she began hammering at the wood again. She wasn't ready to die. She would get out of here. With or without Jason's help. 8. Cool air pressed against Jessie's face as she followed the brick path that curved along lush green grass all the way to the front entry. Pausing at the doormat, she rang the bell and waited. The sprawling estate where Arlene's friend Karen Casso lived was set among majestic oaks, mossy rocks, and cleared meadows. Beautiful. The man who answered the door was tall and distinguished, with thick gray hair that was swept neatly over one eye. He wore light-colored slacks and a crisp white-collared shirt peeking out above a light yellow cashmere sweater. Hi. I'm Jesse Cole, private investigator. I tried to call first, but I wasn't able to get through. I hope I'm not catching you at a bad time. None of that was true, but the white lie worked more times than not. It was easier for people to give excuses over the phone rather than face to face.
Bill,
he said,
what can I do for you?
I was hoping I could talk to Karen Casso about the disappearance of her good friend Arlene Snyder. A woman came forward, sliding easily between the doorframe and Bill. If she was Arlene's friend, Jesse deduced that she would be around the same age, which would be late 50s to early 60s. She looked much younger.
I'm Karen, she said. Did I hear you say Arlene Snyder's name?
This is Jesse Cole, Bill cut in. She's an investigator.
Jesse nodded, smiled, and said, Arlene's daughter, Penny, hired me. Karen raised a brow.
Whatever for?
She wants to know the truth about what happened to her mother all those years ago.
Gosh, what do you want to know?
Anything you can tell me about Arlene would be a great start.
Have you talked to her parents, Dorothy and Ellis Cash?
Karen asked. I was there an hour ago, Jesse said. It's too painful for them to talk about their daughter. They are firm in their belief that she was murdered by her husband and therefore see no reason to go back in time and relive everything that happened. Karen looked at her husband.
I don't see any reason why I shouldn't talk to her, do you, Bill?
It's your call, honey.
Karen touched her necklace as if unsure, but finally gestured for Jesse to come inside. Thank you, Jesse said. I appreciate it. Karen and Bill were attentive hosts. Once they were certain Jesse was settled in a comfortable seat in the living room, they both disappeared. Bill was the first to reappear, with tea for two, and a plate of cheeses and bite-sized pieces of sourdough bread he'd made himself. When Karen returned with a stack of photo albums, Bill left them alone.
I see Bill brought you something to snack on. Jesse nodded as she chewed and swallowed.
It's delicious.
He retired a few months ago, Karen whispered.
Thank God he likes to make bread. Jesse smiled as Karen took a seat next to Jesse and opened one of the albums. Karen flipped through a few pages before pointing at a woman sitting under an umbrella at the beach.
That's her. That's Arlene.
Karen examined the photo for a long moment.
Five of us girls took a trip to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, after graduating from UC Davis.
She turned the page. Every third or fourth picture included Arlene at one party or another. Karen set the first album aside and grabbed another from the pile and peeked inside.
Ah, this is what I was looking for.
She handed the album to Jesse.
Arlene and Nathaniel's wedding day, Karen said, pointing. I was the maid of honor. I forget the name of the best man.
She pondered on it a bit before blurting,
Rhett! The best man's name was Rhett. I remember teasing him and calling him Rhett Butler.
She rolled her eyes. Did it surprise you when you heard the news about Arlene's disappearance?
Yes and no, Karen said. Yes, because Arlene adored being a mother to little Penny. And no, because she often expressed her regret about marrying too soon.
So she was unhappy in her marriage?
Nathaniel was 15 years older than Arlene. Not that that matters. I mean, I don't think that was the reason she was unhappy. In fact, I think she loved her husband. But she just wasn't ready to be tied down. It was little things that bothered Arlene.
What sort of things?
Arlene wanted to go to nice dinners and travel the world. Nathaniel wanted to save for their future.
When did Arlene first start showing signs of unhappiness? Was it right after they were married, or was it after Penny was born? Karen clicked her tongue.
Let's see. I recall Arlene using Erica, another friend of ours, and me, as examples of the life she wanted. We were both single. We would take weekend trips to San Diego or Santa Barbara. Erica and I also traveled to Bali once and spent a couple of weeks there.
She paused to think.
So Penny was probably 3 and a half the first time Arlene said anything to me about wishing she'd waited to marry and have children.
Karen tapped her head lightly.
What am I thinking? No, the first time Arlene expressed regret was during Penny's second birthday party. She and Nathaniel invited everyone over for a barbecue. Her parents were there, and so was Nathaniel's mom. Yes, that was the first time I remember Arlene expressing her unhappiness and doubt about the life she'd chosen for herself.
Do you think maybe she was just having a bad day?
Possibly. I didn't think much of it at first, but after I traveled to Bali, her complaints increased. I still might not have thought too much of it all if she hadn't gotten so upset when I told her I was going to marry Bill. I thought she'd be excited. Instead, she read off a long list of reasons why I should think twice before saying I do.
Obviously, you didn't listen to your friend's advice.
Oh, no, Karen said. Bill's the best thing that's ever happened to me. We have three wonderful boys, all 2 years apart. Raising those boys could be trying at times, but I wouldn't change a thing. Jessie sipped her tea.
Did the police interview you after Arlene disappeared?
Yes, they did, more than once. I heard through the grapevine that Nathaniel thought I knew more than I was telling them. She frowned. To this day, I have a hard time wrapping my head around everything that happened. I liked Nathaniel. When Arlene grumbled about being tied down, I told her she was being foolish. Nathaniel was a wonderful and supportive man. He promised to take her to Paris someday. When she talked about going back to college for her master's, he was all for it. In my opinion, he never tried to stop her from doing whatever it was she wanted to do.
What about abuse?
Physical abuse? Jessie nodded. I never once saw any signs that Arlene had been verbally or physically abused.
She lifted both hands for emphasis and said,
I never witnessed one fight between Arlene and Nathaniel.
So what did you think when the jury found Nathaniel guilty?
I thought it was absolutely insane. I always thought of myself as being a good judge of character. If Nathaniel killed Arlene, then all bets were off.
Meaning?
Meaning I could no longer trust my instincts, let alone anyone I knew. If that man could hurt someone, then everyone I knew was suspect. For years after, I gave everyone in my family the side eye.
Jessie inwardly smiled. If Arlene wasn't murdered or kidnapped, my first thought would be that she ran away.
For years I've been telling Bill that I think she ran off and started a new life in some exotic location.
Jessie lifted an eyebrow. Where would that be?
That's the million-dollar question. Mexico? Hawaii? Bali? Who the heck knows?
Why would Arlene do something so drastic? Why run off, leaving everything behind instead of simply divorcing the man?
I've thought about that too, Karen said. I think she was a coward.
Could you elaborate?
Certainly. Plainly put, Arlene was a chicken shit. She was obsessed with caring what people thought about her. How could she leave her daughter and husband for no other reason than wanting to be free, wanting something new, for wanting more?
Jessie shook her head. You would have to be downright evil to let the father of your child go to jail knowing he was innocent.
Karen shrugged. Maybe she didn't know. Or maybe something happened to her after she ran off.
She made a tisking noise.
You've got your work cut out for you, don't you?
It seems so, Jessie said. Any other friends or acquaintances of Arlene's that you think might be helpful to my investigation?
It's been so long, but maybe Pam Carr could help you. Pam and Arlene were very close at one time.
Jessie jotted down the name. Does she live around here?
She used to live in Sacramento, but we lost touch soon after Arlene disappeared. I really have no idea where she's living or what she's doing these days.
Were you and Pam close at one time?
Truthfully, I always considered her to be an odd duck. But she and Arlene always seemed to get along fabulously. Though without Arlene around, there was no longer anything to keep Pam and me connected.
Bill stepped into the room holding a cell phone.
It's Callan,
he said to his wife. Karen's face lit up. She jumped to her feet.
I need to talk to my son, she told Jessie. Callan is my youngest, and he met a girl recently. We think she might be the one.
After Karen grabbed the phone from her husband, chatting excitedly as she walked off, Bill looked at Jessie and shrugged.
If I could help you, I would.
Jessie stacked the photo books on the coffee table and began to gather her things. You never met Arlene?
Once, a few weeks before our wedding. She asked me where Karen and I were going for our honeymoon. When I told her Kauai, She looked absolutely devastated, said she'd always wanted to visit the islands. I hardly knew the woman, but I do remember feeling bad for mentioning it.
Was she in your wedding? Jesse asked as he walked her through the house, back the way she'd come in.
She was supposed to be a bridesmaid, but she disappeared a few weeks before our big day.
Jesse frowned. That must have been a difficult time.
Karen was very upset with Arlene, convinced she'd run off.
After a jury found him guilty, did Karen change her mind about Nathaniel?
No,
he said, shaking his head.
She always thought he was innocent. After reading about Nathaniel's release, I recall Karen feeling vindicated, knowing she'd been right about the man.
Bill opened the door for Jesse.
Hold on,
he said.
I'll be right back.
By the time Jesse had stepped outside, he returned with a bag in his hand.
Here,
he said, handing it to her.
A loaf of bread to enjoy with dinner.
Thank you so much for everything. As she started toward her car, she tried to absorb what she'd just heard. Karen seemed to think Arlene had simply packed up and run off to start a new life, possibly in some exotic land. It sounded outlandish, downright inconceivable. Jesse didn't know Arlene, but she knew it wouldn't be easy to leave a child. If Arlene Snyder did pack up and leave, did she know her husband might end up being a suspect in her disappearance? Nobody could be that selfish. Or could they? She thought of Dorothy and Ellis Cash and found herself reconsidering. Yeah, there were a lot of selfish assholes out there. And maybe Arlene was willing to push everyone else aside for her own benefit. After Penny Snyder had first paid her a visit, Jesse put Arlene's name and date of birth into more than a few databases. Not unexpectedly, she found close to 1,000 people by that name. She then did a search using Arlene's social security number. Many investigators considered that to be a slam dunk when it came to finding someone. Unfortunately, when she typed in the number, Arlene showed up as being deceased in the same year she disappeared. If Arlene were alive, she most likely would have needed a job, in which case she would also need a social security number. Or maybe not. Arlene might not have been suicidal, but she could have been suffering from a mental illness that caused her to wander. Worse, she could have been a victim of abduction or kidnapping. Jesse unlocked her car and slid into the driver's seat. It might be time to pull Z onto the case. They would need to check mortuaries and hospitals and continue to question people who knew Arlene Snyder. Like working an archaeological dig or piecing together a puzzle, investigative work was tedious at times. Searching and assembling the evidence took days, months, sometimes years. Nothing would be solved until she dug up that one important clue, or found that last squiggly piece of the puzzle that would ultimately bring it all together to a satisfying conclusion. 9. Ben was watching his daughter practice soccer in an indoor facility in Rockland when his phone buzzed. It was Melanie.
Hey,
he said.
What's going on?
I'm running late, his wife told him. Do you think you could pick up Sean at the Cranstons on your way home?
Not a problem. Everything okay?
Just the usual emergency room chaos.
I'll pick up dinner, too.
You're a saint.
I don't know about that, but I love you, and I'll see you at home.
Ben ended the call in time to watch Abigail score a goal. A few months ago, he and his wife had separated for a few weeks. It had been rough on the kids, on all of them. He was glad to be home. Having a routine gave him a sense of normalcy despite the chaos inside his head.
Way to go!
He cheered when Abigail glanced his way. Practice ended 10 minutes later. One of the girls' mothers had played college soccer and volunteered to coach the team. She made the game fun and knew how to keep the kids engaged. While the team talked things over, Ben gestured to Abigail, letting her know he would wait for her outside. The facility, partitioned off by a half wall, was big enough to allow for 2 practices at once. As he made his way to the door, he recognized Paige Willis, Roger Willis's oldest daughter, playing on the indoor field at the far corner. He stopped to let his gaze roam slowly over the people sitting on the bleachers. He didn't see either of her parents. As soon as Ben stepped outside, he heard shouting,
Across the parking lot, he saw Peyton White, the father of the girl who'd been molested in the theater by Roger, waving his arms and yelling. Ben jogged toward the commotion.
"Get in your car and go!"
Peyton shouted, pointing toward the parking lot exit.
"Get out of here before I call the police!"
As Ben approached, the person Peyton was yelling at got out of the car. Ben recognized the man at once. Roger Willis had balls. Wasn't it just yesterday that he'd gotten out on bail? Willis shut his car door, making sure to bump Peyton with his shoulder as he walked by. Peyton wasn't having it. He took a swing, his fist connecting with the middle of Willis's face. Blood spurted from Willis's nose, but Peyton wasn't finished with him. He lunged at the man, taking Willis to the ground.
"Stop this!"
a woman pleaded from her car across the way.
"Come on,"
Ben said, pulling Peyton to his feet.
"This isn't the time or the place."
Peyton was on his feet, hovering over the man, Willis's shirt clutched in his fist.
"I gave him a chance to get out of here, but he thinks he's above the law. Thinks he can do whatever he wants."
Blood oozed from the corner of Willis's mouth.
"I didn't go inside,"
he said, knocking Peyton's hand off him before pushing himself to his feet.
"I'm following the rules,"
he told Ben.
"This isn't a goddamn school." "Peyton,"
Ben tried again when he saw the man's hands curl into fists.
"Don't do anything foolish and mess with his upcoming trial. Justice will prevail. We have plenty of witnesses and two more victims have come forward. Let him go."
Peyton hesitated long enough to prompt Ben to decide that now was a good time to lead Peyton away. A large group of people had gathered. Ben glanced around. He saw Abigail standing next to Peyton's daughter just outside the facility. He headed that way, leading Peyton through the crowd.
"Come on, Jane,"
Peyton said to his daughter. Jane's bottom lip trembled when she met her dad's gaze.
"Let's go home."
Peyton turned toward Ben before walking off and said low enough so the girls wouldn't hear,
"He's lucky I didn't kill him."
Behind the wheel of his van, Ben waited for Abigail to buckle up before driving off. Everything that had just happened replayed in his mind. Peyton had every right to be angry. Ben had told Peyton that justice would be served if they took a back seat to the legal system. He was beginning to wonder if that were true. What if Roger Willis was found innocent? What then? Ben drew in a slow, steady breath, but it didn't stop the adrenaline from racing through his body. There was a pounding in his ears. He didn't like the edgy, twitchy sensation coming over him, making him feel as if he might lose control. And then what? He wasn't sure. And that bothered him most of all.
"I thought you said Coach Willis was in jail," Abigail said.
Ben pulled the van over to the side of the road.
"What are you doing, Dad?"
She touched his arm.
"Are you all right?"
Raking his hands through his hair, he nodded, took a deep breath, and did his best to compose himself. But he felt anything but calm. He looked at Abigail, forced a smile.
"Roger Willis was let out on bail, which means someone paid a lot of money to guarantee that he'll show up to court when it's time for his trial."
"But why? What if he hurts someone else? Jane is scared. She told me she's having nightmares and has to sleep with the lights on. How is she going to be able to pay attention at school when she knows he might be right outside waiting for her?"
"I talked to the principal at your school. He and the rest of the teachers and staff are aware of the situation. There will be extra security posted outside to make sure he doesn't come anywhere near the school."
She sucked in a shaky breath. He could see the fear in the tightness of her shoulders. She'd been through so much in the past few months. He couldn't bear to see her like this. Kids her age had enough to deal with. Schoolwork and peer pressure.
"Coach Willis will be back behind bars very soon. And you'll never have to see him again."
"What about Jane?"
"She won't have to see him either."
"You promise?"
"Cross my heart."
10. In order to get Jason to stop whining and help the two of them escape, Lacey had made a deal with her husband.
Whenever they were both too exhausted to work, they would try to sleep. After some rest, they would hammer away. They had been working for hours, doing their best to stay within a 1-foot by 1-foot area. But when it came time to rest, Lacey never slept. Instead, she lay in silence listening to Jason breathe, hoping and praying she would free fall into oblivion, just for an hour or two. This went on for hours, maybe days. She'd completely lost any ability to keep track of time. Without light to help her tell the time of day, without enough sleep, without the ability to move more than a few inches at a time, she was beginning to lose hope. Being in the dark, surrounded by quiet, had also given her too much time to think about and analyze her relationship with Jason, because she didn't like where her thoughts were taking her. She was coming to the cold, hard realization that their marriage was a farce, and it was as much her fault as it was his. She'd missed all the signs, and she had a feeling it all stemmed from the life she'd escaped as a teenager. With Jason, she'd seen so much potential, so many possibilities. She had a house of her own, a car, food on the table. His shitty behavior was nothing compared to the life she'd run away from at the age of...
Are you awake?
Jason asked, interrupting her thoughts.
Yes.
I don't want to die,
he said.
I'm scared. Why did you have to make such a big deal about our anniversary? We should have...
Of course, she should have known. He was blaming her for their predicament. She picked up the shoe and slammed it against the wood. Every time he tried to speak, she did it again. Laughter bubbled up inside of her. Was she going insane? She felt so far removed from the woman she was only days ago. Dirt fell through the spot where she'd been beating her shoe.
I did it!
Excitement thrummed through her body. Her last swung had broken through the very center of the square. Grains of dirt fell through. The hole wasn't big enough to worry about the two of them being suffocated. Not yet.
Now what?
Jason asked.
I need to make sure the entire area is weak enough for me to break through.
Jason made a tisking noise with his tongue. It was a familiar habit of his, something he did when he disagreed with her. Funny how it had never irritated her before this moment.
I don't think this is a good idea,
he said.
It's our only option, Jason. Why don't you understand that? If we stay here and do nothing, we might have hours to live. There's no way of knowing for sure.
But her instincts told her it was true. She'd been feeling dizzy and lightheaded. They needed to get out of here fast.
What about the dirt?
Jason asked, his voice quivery.
Once you try to dig your way out of here, it will cave in and I'll be suffocated, buried alive.
He didn't care about anyone but himself.
Just keep your mouth on the pipe, she told him. That's all you have to do. You'll be fine. I'll be the one to suffocate if I can't break through.
It was quiet for a moment before he said,
Okay, you're right.
You don't care about our baby, do you?
I never wanted to have children. That was all you.
Her pulse quickened.
You never once told me you didn't want children. I talked about having a family since the day we met. You never said a word.
He said nothing. He didn't have to. The truth smacked her in the head. Whenever she'd talked about having children over the years, he'd clammed up. She swallowed.
Are you okay?
He asked. No, I'm not okay.
Nothing. She wanted to laugh out loud. Yep, she was definitely losing it. She'd never been an angry person, but at the moment, she hated him more than she'd hated anyone. Or, at least, as much. She wasn't fucking okay. She was hungry and thirsty, her head was pounding, and they were probably going to die in here. But she kept it all to herself.
We're going to have to keep hammering, she said in a controlled tone of voice.
When the hole becomes large enough, I'll need you to put your hand through the opening and pull down on the wood, bringing it toward you. It's the only way to give me enough space to try and push through. After a long pause, she said,
"Did you hear me?"
She heard a noise. It sounded as if he was crying.
"I heard you,"
he finally said.
"Are you ready? Are you going to try to break through the wood now?"
"No, I love you," when this could very well be their last conversation. The past 6 months flashed through her mind. Jason had been working long hours. When he did have time off, he spent it with his brother and his friends, and he never invited her along. She'd spent most of her free time making his favorite dishes for dinner, and yet he might as well have been eating soup from a can, judging by his reaction when he sat down to eat. The few conversations they'd had were stilted and awkward. He would pick fights for no reason, and she couldn't remember the last time he'd appeared happy to see her. It bothered her to know that it took being buried alive with the man to see everything so clearly. Yes, their marriage was a farce, but had it always been that way? Jason might never have been the amazing husband she'd thought he was, but had he ever been happy? Had she been so obsessed with getting pregnant that she'd ignored all the signs of being in a dysfunctional relationship?
"I'm ready,"
he said. Tired of overthinking everything, she picked up the shoe and started banging. It wasn't long after that when the hole was big enough. Jason didn't have to be reminded of what to do. She could hear the wood cracking as he pulled. A large chunk of particle board dropped to his side. Dirt came in through the hole as she scooted to the right. Holding her breath, she reached upward, got a good grip on the other side of the hole, and pulled. The board broke. As quick as humanly possible, she twisted around, contorting her body so that she was on bent knees, her back against the dirt coming through the hole. Dizziness washed over her. Her insides burned. Time was running out. Using every bit of strength she could summon, she thought about living to raise her child. Jason might not want children, but she did. She wanted to be free. She wanted to survive. Screaming, she pushed upward, digging furiously through soil on both sides of her, shocked when her head popped out of the dirt. She sucked in a breath, and then another as she shoved away splinters of broken wood until she stood on wobbly legs. Excitement turned to confusion when her head smacked against a low ceiling. What the fuck? Bits of light came through a vent nearby, enough light to throw eerie shadows around. They had been buried inside a small room with three cement walls. The fourth wall was made of wood. A lump caught in her throat. No, 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 it couldn't be. This was insane. She wasn't outside. This couldn't be happening. Covered to her waist in dirt, she estimated there to be 2 feet of earth above the box they'd been buried in. She pulled herself out. At 5 feet 2 inches tall, she had to stoop to walk around. There wasn't much to see. Her eyes watered. "You will not cry," she scolded herself. No food or water anywhere in sight. She went to the wall made of wood and pushed her weight against it, pounding her fists all the way across, up and down, desperate to find a door or a weak spot. It was solid. Nothing like the particle board she'd just broken through. Her stomach churned. Glancing back at the pipe sticking out of the particle board, she knew it was time to save Jason. She stepped into the box and began breaking off pieces of wood and tossing them aside. It wasn't until she'd removed the dirt from around Jason's face and chest that he finally opened his eyes. Jerking upright, his eyes wide and filled with panic, he sucked air into his lungs.
"What happened?"
he asked.
"Where are we?"
"Well," she said without humor, "it looks like we're in another box, only this one is bigger and made mostly of cement." He crawled out on all fours, then looked back at her.
"What the hell is going on?"
"We're fucked, Jason. We are completely and totally fucked."
11. Wednesday morning, Jessie was at her desk when she picked up a call. It was Colin. He started the conversation with,
"I miss you.
Can you meet me for breakfast at the Cornerstone Cafe in the morning?"
Sounds good. What's the catch?
Jesse laughed.
How did you know there was a catch?
It's all in the tone.
I was hoping you could look up an old case and let me know if you find anything interesting.
What's the name?
Arlene Snyder.
Got it.
Colin said.
How are you holding up?
I'm fine. How about you?
The same.
He laughed. What's so funny?
I was just thinking we could record one of our conversations and just hit play every morning.
That's not funny, Jesse said. It's sort of sad.
Maybe we should take a look at the calendar and schedule a getaway.
With the kids?
Of course. If it were just the two of us, I wouldn't know what to do with myself.
He teased. It was Jesse's turn to laugh.
Time's up. Gotta go.
I love you.
Love you too.
2 seconds after the call ended, Jesse's cell buzzed as Z walked through the office door.
I'm going to pick up this call,
Jesse told her. Don't run off until we've had a chance to talk. I'll head upstairs and get our usual.
Great.
Jesse picked up the call. Jesse Cole, how can I help you?
Good morning. Grant Taylor here with Taylor and Fitch Investigations in beautiful Phoenix, Arizona.
A scuffling noise and murmuring sounded in the background.
Sorry about the noise,
the man said.
We're doing a little remodeling over here.
Not a problem.
I've heard a lot about you and the work you do, and I was hoping you might be interested in working with me on an unusual case.
This wasn't the first time an investigative firm in another area had called for help. It wasn't a common practice, but it happened. What's it about?
I'm basically looking for a missing person, which I've been told you specialize in. Her name is Anne Elizabeth Corrigan. In a nutshell, Anne has a very large inheritance coming her way. Over $1 million left to her by her grandmother, who passed away recently. We've run all the usual searches, but have come up empty-handed.
A loud crash sounded, prompting Jesse to hold the phone away from her ear.
Damn, are you still there?
Jesse inwardly sighed.
I'm here.
So what do you think? Interested?
I charge $75 an hour.
She was about to add that she had a full schedule and wasn't sure if she had the time to look for Anne Corrigan.
I'm willing to pay you double that.
She perked up a bit. It must be a difficult case, she thought. Otherwise, they would have located the woman already.
I would need a $5,000 non-refundable deposit for any possible costs accrued.
Done.
This was way too easy. What was he hiding? How old is Anne Corrigan?
33.
That ruled out a runaway teenager. Do you know where she was born?
New Jersey.
Social security number? Jesse asked.
Yes,
but it leads nowhere.
Jesse finished for him.
Correct. We know she left home at the age of 16 because her mother filed a missing persons report at the time.
Did anyone follow up? Was there an investigation?
Not as far as I can tell. Her biological father passed away when Anne was 10. Her mother remarried a man by the name of Everett Miller. Looks like the mom still lives in New Jersey. Not sure about the stepdad. Nobody has returned my calls.
Was the girl abused? Is that why she ran off?
No idea.
Since you're calling me, I assume Anne Corrigan is connected to Sacramento in some way.
Correct. It's a long shot, but it's all we have to go on.
Mr. Taylor said,
in the files that I'll send you, if you agree to take the case, you'll see 2 pictures. One is of a 10-year-old Anne Elizabeth Corrigan with her grandmother. The other is a photo of a young couple announcing their marriage in the Sacramento Tribune. Lacey Page just married Jason Geiger. The woman in the photo resembles Anne Elizabeth Corrigan.
How in the world did you make the connection between a 10-year-old girl and a woman in a wedding announcement?
It was a damn miracle. We spent a lot of money on ads asking if anyone had seen Anne Corrigan. Lo and behold, we got a call from a woman in Sacramento who said she used to be in charge of archiving articles, including announcements. Told us she never forgets a face.
Jesse held back a snort. The odds of Lacey Page and Anne Corrigan being the same person had to be astronomical.
Did you use age progression software on the 10-year-old?
He cleared his throat.
Well, no. It's complicated.
How did you get involved in the case? Jesse wanted to know.
Friend of a friend,
he laughed.
It's all about who you know in this business.
The guy sounded friendly enough, Jesse thought, but shady too.
I'll make the check out to the Jesse Cole agency and send it to the address listed. Or would you rather give me banking information so I can make a direct deposit?
A check is fine. She gave him the information he requested so he could send copies of the information in his file.
There is one more thing,
he said. Jesse waited.
This particular case needs to be settled right away.
There's a deadline?
Afraid so. It was brought to my attention recently that the heir needs to be found on or before the end of this month, or the money goes to charity.
That's 2 weeks away.
Correct.
I'm sorry. There's no possible way I can...
There's a $25,000 bonus, no strings attached, if you succeed in finding her.
Seriously?
Seriously.
I would need that in writing, along with proof of funds.
Not a problem.
Forget sending a check for the $5,000, she told him. I think it would be best, after all, if you made the direct deposit.
More information was exchanged before Jesse ended the call. She was still thinking about the conversation when the door came open and Z appeared with paper cups in hand. Her timing was impeccable. Z placed Jesse's coffee on her desk in front of her.
What's wrong? Did something happen?
I just got off the phone with an investigator in Arizona. He wants me to help him find someone.
Another missing persons case?
I'm not exactly sure what it is. He's sending me copies of his case files, but it sounds like it might be a situation where this particular someone doesn't want to be found.
So why not leave her be?
Z asked. Because her grandmother died and left her a whole lot of money.
Interesting.
Definitely. But we just got a whole lot busier, and I'm going to need your help.
Finally!
When can you finish with the workers' comp case?
By the end of the day. The man said he injured himself in the company parking lot. And then yesterday, he posted on social media for all the world to see that he actually fell outside his home. He was quite proud of himself since he'd already collected over $1,000 in benefits.
Not the brightest crayon in the box.
Nope.
Okay, you finish that up. I have other things to work on. I'm meeting with Colin in the morning after he's had a chance to look into the Arlene Snyder case. Let's check back here at 10:30 and discuss what needs to be done.
10:04. I'll be ready to roll.
12. Ben glanced at his watch. 8:15 p.m. He and Melanie were at the Sullivan home, a few miles from their house. Gretchen Sullivan had set up a neighborhood meeting to talk about bullying at the kids' school. For an hour, they'd discussed the importance of being observant about any changes in a child's demeanor, since victims are reluctant to speak up because they often feel ashamed. It was helpful if parents knew the signs and symptoms of the victim and the bully. After the discussion died down, a few of the men, Ben included, sat in front of the TV, mindlessly watching a football game as their wives caught up with each other. Ben was tired, ready to go home. A few feet away, Melanie was in a huddle with three women. He waited 15 minutes before giving her the eye and gesturing at his watch. Melanie said something to Gretchen Sullivan, who was standing beside her. A single mother, Gretchen was raising two daughters while working full-time. As if that wasn't enough, she somehow found the time to be an active member of the PTA and host elaborate fundraisers. He'd heard Melanie complain that Gretchen's children were always immaculately dressed and well-behaved. Melanie wanted to know how she found the time to pack organic lunches, jog every day, and arrange meetings like the one tonight. Ben didn't know how Gretchen managed, nor did he care. It was getting late, and they still needed to pick up the kids and get them to bed.
Okay, people,
Gretchen said, clapping her hands together. One of the men sitting next to Ben picked up the remote and shut off the television.
Before everyone runs off, I wanted to let you know that it has been brought to my attention that Roger Willis was let out on bail.
Murmurs erupted around the room.
Yesterday, Roger Willis was seen by some of you sitting in his car in the parking lot of an indoor sporting facility. He was in plain view and only a few feet away from the entrance to the building where dozens of young girls were practicing soccer. As you may or may not be aware, there are multiple victims who have come forward to say they were abused by Mr. Willis.
Ben kept his eyes on Melanie. She stood tall, nodding her head at everything Gretchen was saying. Ben felt uneasy.
He didn't like the idea of Roger Willis being discussed in any manner that might jeopardize the case. He'd once covered a story about a group of vigilantes who attempted to take matters into their own hands concerning a pedophile. In that case, significant resources had to be diverted to protect the suspect. In the end, nobody won.
I would like to ask all of you to come to the next city council meeting to protest Roger Willis's release. At the very least, he should be ordered to wear an ankle bracelet so we know where he is at all times.
A woman whose name Ben didn't know said,
I read about a pedophile recently jailed thanks to a group of concerned citizens who duped him into meeting a young girl at the mall. He was caught red-handed on video.
Wouldn't that be considered illegal entrapment? Someone asked.
Even worse news, Gretchen said,
ignoring the question about entrapment,
is that I have it on good authority that Roger has been abusing his daughter, Paige. She confided as much to a friend.
She paused to collect herself.
How can we stand by and do nothing?
Everyone started talking at once. Ben took that opportunity to get up and make his way over to Melanie.
We've been here for over an hour. It's past the kids' bedtime.
Give me 2 minutes to let Gretchen know we're leaving.
Ben let himself out and waited for Melanie outside. She appeared a few minutes later, and they walked to the car.
What's wrong?
She asked Ben as they drove off.
Between Pate and White throwing Willis to the ground and getting in a couple of good hits, and now this, a group of wannabe vigilantes talking about illegally ensnaring the guy, I'm worried Willis will be let go on some crazy technicality.
You were so fired up about Willis, Melanie said,
ready to beat the crap out of him on the soccer field only months ago. But now, suddenly, you want everyone to keep his or her distance and hope the system takes care of him? You know what happened to Jane in the theater. It could have been Abigail.
Silence had no chance to settle before she added,
what if you hadn't been there to pick up Abigail yesterday? What if you weren't able to get there until 5 or 10 minutes after practice and she waited outside for you, alone? Would Roger Willis have tried to talk to her? Anything could have happened, and it chills me to the bone.
If Melanie had any idea of the turmoil caused by the mere mention of Roger's name, she would let it go. But he didn't want her to know about the uncontrollable tremors he experienced, or how his pulse elevated whenever he thought about the man.
Trust me, Melanie. It chills me, too. Roger will be tried before a judge and jury. I just think it would be best if we stayed calm until then.
Didn't you hear what Gretchen said about Roger abusing his own child?
It's hearsay. We have no proof.
Ben answered.
As you've said many times, Gretchen tends to exaggerate and can be overly dramatic.
It sounds as if you're defending the man.
No,
Ben said.
I would never defend him.
The truth was, Ben wasn't comfortable talking about Roger Willis these days. Just hearing his name clouded his vision and made it difficult to think straight. For the past 24 hours, he'd felt as if he were hanging on by a thread, trying hard to at least appear unruffled.
Well, Gretchen has good reason to be upset at the moment. She was a victim of sexual abuse herself when she was young. The whole Roger Willis situation has obviously hit too close to home.
Are you going to attend the city council meeting?
Ben asked.
Definitely.
Ben pulled into the driveway and shut off the engine. The kids were just across the street. It wasn't easy balancing his inner hostility toward Willis with his desire to protect his family. He turned toward Melanie.
I want that man behind bars just as much as anyone else. I don't want the two of us arguing over anything that has to do with Roger Willis. I'll go to the city council meeting. If it'll make you feel better, I will also go to Roger's house and talk to him in the flesh.
And say what?
I would tell him if he ever so much as talks to Abigail, I will...
No more talk of Roger Willis,
she said softly.
You're a good man, and our kids are lucky to have you to protect them. Please don't go near that man's house.
She exhaled.
You're right. I say we forget about going to the city council meeting. Stay clear of the whole thing until the trial.
Ben felt some of the tension leave his shoulders.
Are you sure that's what you want to do?
I'm sure.
13. His hatred for Jason Geiger had been like a cancer, dividing and spreading, damaging tissues and organs. But listening to the man lose his shit down there in the hole made everything better, despite the occasional bout of paranoia, and especially now that he'd gotten his nerves under control. The first time he'd met Jason was when he was 20 years old. Jason had seemed like a good guy, fair and even-tempered. Years later, he realized he couldn't have been more wrong. Jason had turned out to be the exact opposite of the man he pretended to be. He was a narcissist, a pathological liar, and a sneaky asshole who cared only about himself. Yeah, sure, the world was filled with assholes. Everybody had run into at least one in their lifetime. But Jason was different. He was truly evil. Nobody knew that better than he did. He'd been watching Jason long enough to know that the man thoroughly enjoyed others' misfortunes. He wanted others to like him so that he could gain their trust. That was why he went out of his way to be polite, bordering on charming. Control was everything to a man like Jason. If he couldn't control every aspect of his life, he felt powerless. He knew all of this because he'd worked closely with Jason for over a year. Short, but not sweet. In the end, he'd lost everything. As his life had crumbled around him, fueled by revenge, he'd become obsessed with learning everything he could about Jason Geiger, spending much of his time gathering information on the man. Never before had he been so obsessed with anything or anyone. He spent a lot of time watching Jason from afar, taking endless videos of him walking to and from his car, or hanging out at a bar with his friends. If he wasn't following Jason, he was usually on the phone talking to one of Jason's clients. He'd tell them he was considering working with Jason on a project and wanted to know if they had any information that might help him make an informed decision. Turned out they had plenty to say. He'd learned that Jason was afraid of his own shadow. One guy he had a long conversation with told him how surprised he'd been to learn of Jason's fear of insects, especially red ants, and how Jason wore tall rubber boots whenever he visited a construction site. Apparently, Jason was also afraid of the dark. A fucking pansy ass. Jason was not the respected businessman that he pretended to be. He lived a double life, never revealing his true self to those closest to him. Once he realized Jason felt no remorse for the lives he'd ruined by refusing to pay people money owed and filing frivolous lawsuits, that was when the real work began. He'd drawn up plans for a house of horrors, custom-made for Jason. Unsure as to whether or not he would be able to get Jason alone, he made sure he had enough room for two people. When he discovered Jason was having an affair, he got excited about the idea of burying Jason with his wife, figuring that would only add to his discomfort. He did the work himself, the excavation, the air vent, forming and pouring concrete walls and ceiling. And then there was the key and the box filled with red ants, water bottles and food, so many details that Jason had yet to discover. At first, he considered leaving the couple with flashlights and instructions, teasing Jason by giving him false hope that they'd make it out of there. But that would have been too easy. Instead, he decided to leave just enough food and water to keep two people alive for a week or two. At the last minute, he also decided to leave Lacey a picture of Jason with his mistress. The more drama, the better. Ultimately, he wanted Jason to sit in a small, cramped space, day in and day out, knowing he was going to die. He wanted to listen to him whine and moan. Mostly, he wanted Jason to suffer. After completing the underground room, he'd spent months working on a plan to get Jason into his car. It was during that time that he discovered Jason and his wife had an anniversary coming up. Obviously, Jason wasn't happily married, but he hadn't left his wife, so it was worth a shot. He promptly began sending Lacey Geiger fraudulent emails from the best restaurants in town, even went so far as to suggest dinner at the firehouse for half price.
He'd taken a few graphic design classes in his day, even built his own website, and he knew how to make a decent-looking coupon. Lacey didn't waste any time calling the number on the coupon he sent her, and he did the rest, even called the restaurant and made reservations, just in case she called the firehouse to verify. Then came the offer of transportation. He'd left postcards on both their cars and in their mailbox. For a ridiculous price, his transportation company would drive them to and from the restaurant. Too good to be true? He laughed. Never. Jason liked a good deal as much as his wife did. They ended up being putty in his hands. The best part, after his underground room was finished, had been going to bed at night, dreaming of the day when Jason Geiger would wake up in the dark, only to realize he'd been buried alive. The idea of the biggest asshole on the planet being 8 feet under and having absolutely no control over his dilemma was just too damn good. 14. Jesse met Colin for breakfast at the Cornerstone Cafe and Bar downtown. When she walked through the door, Colin waved her over. For years, their relationship had been moving forward at a snail's pace, which suited them both. Neither of them was worried about taking it to the next level. Jesse appreciated their similarities. They were both workaholics, and yet they were respectful in that they didn't check emails or multitask on the phone when they were together. Jesse had dated two men before Colin. Both times, she'd felt suffocated. She didn't like having someone breathing down her neck all the time. Colin was the exact opposite. He wasn't needy, compliant, or dull. He stood, greeted her with a kiss. They slipped into the booth across from each other. When the waitress came, they didn't waste any time. Colin ordered a breakfast burrito stuffed with scrambled eggs, sausage, ham, onions, bell peppers, and cheese. Jesse didn't usually get hungry until later in the day, but the smell of maple syrup prompted her to order French toast and coffee.
Busy day ahead?
He asked once they were alone again. Always. What about you?
Same. You look beautiful this morning,
he said. She smiled, taking in his rugged good looks. He wore an old faded Ramones t-shirt and jeans. He was 39, but he could easily pass for 10 years younger. Not fair. Going undercover, I see. Nodding, he looked down at his shirt.
Piper picked it out for me.
Your daughter has good taste. How is she?
She's an 11-year-old girl obsessed with Katy Perry. I'm completely out of my element.